Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Here in central London, popcorn is being hoovered from floors, red carpets are being rolled back up, and the British film industry and one or two of its critics are nursing one long hangover. No names specifically mentioned around the table. As another year of the London Film Festival has wrapped up, on the show today we'll be looking at some of our critics' highlights and maybe lowlights, we'll see, of the event. Those critics joining me today are Jason Solomons and Karen Krizanovich. So what will we be watching on a screen near us over the coming weeks? Find out today on the Monocle Arts Review. Karen and Jason, welcome to the programme.
Thank you for having us.
Always good to have you with us. You've spent the last few weeks to-ing and fro-ing between screenings for the London Film Festival. Jason, overall takeaways, first of all, from you, LFF 2017.
It's very big. It really is. It's very big and it's all over the place. And it's very difficult to convince people that it's still going on. You know, the opening night happens and you go, great. And then when the closing night happens, you say to your friends, they say, well, come out. And they say, you say, you can't because I'm going to the closing night festival. They say, of what? And I say, the London Film Festival. They go, Christ, is that still on? And it is. And they said, well, we didn't know anything about it. And these are normal. But, you know, these are not like people who kind of willfully stick their heads in the stand. These are not kind of arch Brexiteers who have no sort of cultural heft at all. These are people who you would expect to know that London Film Festival is on. It's a really hard thing to sustain because Freeze opens at the same time. The England football team will play at the same time. Young Frankenstein will open up in the West End at the same time. There's another six play openings and big exhibition. London is a big cultural centre and it's really hard to have a massive sort of 12-day festival at the heart of it, especially when no one knows where it is. So that's the problem with the London Film Festival. That said, they have some great films and they're in a great spot because they're kind of at the start of award season. So all the best films in the world that have played at other festivals during the world come here, and then the ones that are about to kind of be in the award season also come here. So it's at this nexus in terms of the calendar that is absolutely kind of a gift for a festival programmer like Claire Stewart, who does a very good job of programming a load of films, 267 films. I mean, you know, you can't really go wrong. You're going to get some wrong, but you're going to get a lot right too.
We'll talk about some of those hits and maybe some misses as well. But Karen, is that part of the problem maybe? And maybe one of the reasons why London Film Festival won't ever be seen maybe as a sort of prestige play like your Cannes or your Venice? Is it a bit because London, there's too much happening? Is that the problem?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, traditionally, I've always sort of likened it to Rome in a way. I think I always just look at if you went to a lot of festivals, if you went to Cannes or you went to Venice or even, you know, San Sebastian or anything, you'd come back and there'd be very little on the festival roster that you haven't seen. So it's really kind of a sweep up because it's the end of the sort of the release cycle, as it were. And I know that some people time it to try and start the awards cycle. But I just found that it was sort of a lot of stuff I'd either seen already, you know, because I would, or things that I thought, oh, it's not going to get distribution. So, see, I'm more interested in films that actually have a distribution deal rather than, I mean, there was one time at San Sebastian where I saw an amazing film. Like, God, it still sticks in my mind. It never got distribution, and then the director had a heart attack and died. So it's like, I don't want that kind of pain again. So I really do try and focus on things that people are actually going to see and talk about, rather than interesting films that maybe will lead to another interesting film.
But some people think that's the point of a festival.
Yeah,
especially
of course.
Like a London Film Festival, you've got to see these films because they might not get picked up, and therefore, either it's because they're no good, or two, because they're, right now, very, very difficult to program. Foreign films in this country are ill-served. Unless you're Almodovar or unless you're Assayas or Ozon or maybe Lars von Trier, you've got very little chance of getting on more than 10 screens in this whole country. So to have the kind of amazing kind of amount of European films that are on at the festival, some are good, some are bad, some you don't know, some you never heard of, some you never see again. Some people say, well, take the chance to see one that you might not see again, because the chance of it getting picked up and the chance of it being on near a cinema near you are even slimmer. Even if it does get picked up, the only time you're going to see it is on Curzon Home Video or maybe on Netflix if Netflix are having a kind of magnanimous moment.
I guess, I mean, if you're really, really serious about, and I would consider that almost esoteric, and I think that festivals are very useful for that. But I like films that are actually going to be seen by normal, quote-unquote, people, rather than, you know, the cognoscenti, because I like discussing films with the variety of people, not just people who go, oh, have you seen the Polish 35mm?
But you can do that every week, Karen. You can go to a mall, you can go to High Wycombe 6 and stand in the car park and say, wow, what did you think of Harry Potter 27?
That's
true. You want to do that.
That's true, but I wouldn't want to. But I wouldn't. Not that popular.
I can't quite see you in High Wycombe 6, love.
No. But I think the thing is that I just find that cinema is so alive, and I don't find the preciousness really helpful.
Because I was going to say, Jason, in a sense, is there an argument then for maybe a more focused offer? Should it be in a week rather than 12 days? Should it be fewer movies than the 300?
I've been trying to say to the BFF for years, it was too long, and then they say, well, but we sell out. We got, 200,000 people, so, why should we take, it's a money-making exercise as well. It's just run by the BFI, and they need the money, to pour it back into fresh British voices. But every year I kind of think, well, what's the theme this year? Is it new British voices? Should they be ushering through? We've got so many UK films that don't get screenings either, so it's interesting to see what's coming up. Is there a new movement in UK cinema? Is there a new movement in European cinema? Are the Italians hot this year? Are the French back on track? I mean, those things are not so cognoscenti. Sorrentino's making a movie and people want to go and see The Great Beater, that's kind of a decent discussion to be had, not like the small Italian documentaries or stuff like that. But, are the Americans kind of doing well? How's the studio fare shaping up this year is equally interesting, and what's going to be part of the awards conversation going forward is probably where we really look for our headline galas at the London Film Festival. And then I say to them, well, where are you? You do it in Leicester Square, and then some of it's down at Embankment Gardens, where they have this new pop-up cinema, which I like very much. And it just, every year I kind of think, I wish it was somewhere where I knew where it was, so we could go to the festival, rather than some people hang out in the Picture House Central, which this year, we can't say this without mentioning that there were protests on the red carpet opening and closing nights. Very vocal protests from people saying, LFF off. They was with the signs, because the LFF were using Picture House, which at the moment is locked into zero contract hours for their employees. So should a state organisation like the BFI be using somewhere which is not doing proper employment terms for its... And no, it shouldn't, definitely. And did the BFI address this? No, they didn't.
Do you want to talk about some films?
Let's do that. Yeah. We mentioned award season. Let's talk about then a film that was in competition and indeed took the Best Film Award, Loveless, by Andrei Zvyagintsev.
Very good.
I
had to see him on Saturday night.
Lord, I could see you were waiting to see how I said it.
Are we on Monocle? Yeah. Pronounced it
I'm
properly.
Not going to try and say it again. Jason, what did you make of this one?
Listen, I thought this film should have won the Palme d'Or in Cannes. I mean, there was another film called 120 Beats Per Minute, which I also thought should have won the Palme d'Or. Anyway, neither of them did. And won a really boring film in the middle by Ruben Östlund called The Square sort of came in the middle. And it's fine, but it's nowhere near as good as either of those two. Those two were in competition here at the LFF, which is a strange competition anyway, because it's not an A-list competition and no one knows what the trophy is, and we should do by now, and they didn't know what the trophy was when they designed it a couple of years ago, and now they've remodeled it and it's now the Star of London, and still no one knows what it is, but that's fine. Zvyagintsev won it with Loveless, which I think, in my opinion, if you had to ask me who's the best filmmaker in the world right now, and we could say Haneke and we could say Scorsese and that sort of thing, I think it's this guy, Andrei Zvyagintsev. He's been hot since he made The Return, which won at Venice in 1999. He won the LFF Award for Leviathan, which I think is one of the great films of this century so far. And I think he's back with another film, Loveless, which is equally good. He's not a song and dance man, I've got to tell you. If you want to see nice pictures of Russia, if you want to make it a picture postcard, you want to say, hey, come to our World Cup this summer, don't go see Loveless. It's bleak, it's miserable. It's about a couple going through a divorce and they're just about getting back onto speaking terms when their 12-year-old son goes missing, and it becomes a search for this son all around the kind of neighbourhood, and it's forensic and it's horrible. And it's about the lost Russia and the lost children and the lost generation. He is such a masterful filmmaker. He reminds you of Michael Haneke, but he's got a bit more kind of devil about him, if that's possible. But he's a descendant of Haneke in that kind of cold looking thing, but there's a vastness to it, and there's a drunkenness to it, and there's a violence to it, and there's a sexiness to it, and there's a sort of capitalism kind of skewering of capitalism in there. But he's not like an old communist. He's not like saying, oh, it was great when Stalin was around. He's about like the blingness of modern Russia and the heartlessness, the lovelessness of modern Russia.
I'm inspired by that. I'm just taking a moment to let that settle in. Sort of ambiguity, but hypnotic ambiguity. These are some of the phrases that are bandied around. And I think Jason was talking to that there. Karen, would this draw you in?
Absolutely. It's, he's an amazing
filmmaker.
It's an
emotional challenge to watch, maybe, but...
worth it.
But so was Leviathan. I mean, Leviathan, it's one of these things where you just feel as if you're transported to this country, things are unfolding, and you understand the subtlety and the nuances, and he's so good at grabbing that. He's wonderful with things that shouldn't go together. And I just find him a hypnotic. I mean, you just think Tarkovsky. He's like the new Tarkovsky, really.
Yeah, because the Leviathan was in the country, was like in the northern countryside. God knows where that was. And then he did another film called Elena, which was brilliant about little flat, this kind of bling flat. And this is about property in Russia. Like there's the council flat, and then there's the kind of flat that the husband's got on the side, which is then there's a woman in a kind of Russian gymnast outfit, kind of doing treadmill. You know, it's really
what I really liked, and one of the things that really punched me about this was that the woman admits that she didn't want this child. I got pregnant, and I didn't want him, and I think her mother is just really horrible, really just nasty and unrelenting. And I was thinking, yeah, that's what it's like to be a daughter. Yeah.
Oh, it's really hard. Cool. And then they go and visit grandma, and she lives in one of the old kind of Soviet era blocks. And it's like, oh my, I mean, that's really.
It's the grandmother, yeah.
Really frightening stuff. I mean, it's brilliant. I mean, if you want to know what Russia looks like, anyway, according to Zviagintsev, that's what Russia looks like. I'm sure it does look a bit
What's
like.
What's the running
that.
Time of this?
Long.
Yeah.
No,
a whisker over a couple of hours.
Yeah, I mean, completely well spent. I mean, completely hypnotic. I think he's amazing, to be honest with you.
There you go. Well, Loveless hits UK cinemas on the 10th of November. Let's move on to some of the other films on the bill. Next up, we have Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Catchy title from Martin McDonagh, the man behind Seven Psychopaths in Bruges. Karen, what's this one about?
Well, okay. I don't want to say too much about it because I don't want to ruin it for anybody going to see. Francis McDormand is looking pretty rough in a station wagon, driving through America, sees three disused billboards and really haven't been used for years and years. And then she looks at the sign and drives into town. Now, that's the beginning. And you're thinking to yourself, what is she going to do? So I don't want to ruin it, because if I tell you, it's going to ruin it. So it turns out that her daughter has been killed, and the murder is unsolved. And she uses these billboards to incite the local police into trying to find the murderer. That's really the gist of the story.
And I guess kind of blackly comic, you know, we mentioned some of the previous works, you can in Bruges, Seven Psychopaths, and that's... It's always, you know, people who have a mastery of that kind of blackly comic storytelling are always rather good to watch. And
there not many people have a mastery of it. People have an attempt at mastering it, but very few can do it. Tarantino mastered it. Edgar Wright thinks he's got it. Have you seen Baby Driver? That guy ain't got it. Come on.
Well, not there.
No. But Martin McDonagh, he's got it. Not always. I think he had it in Bruges. I think Seven Psychopaths got lost it a bit. Yeah. And this one, I think he's back on it. Yeah. And the place was, I saw it closing night here. The place was just laughing and then realizing what they're laughing at and kind of shutting up quickly. It's laughter that kind of goes, ha ha, oh. It's dark, dark, dark stuff. Francis McDormand's brilliant. And Sam Rockwell,
amazing.
I was going to ask you about this, because part of the skill, I guess, for those directors who can do this is to get the performances out of the acting talent. And you've got McDormand, you've got Sam Rockwell, lots of people. I mean,
Woody Harrelson.
McDormand, and they seem to, they too, with the right direction, can just deliver that nuance, that blackly comic nuance.
Well, you know, when you see a cast like that, you're just going to sit back and just grab the handles of your chair. I think that McDonagh, I was discussing this with a friend yesterday at lunch. We're saying that a lot of minority, I just feel bad saying minority, people who aren't white or white men, were saying that actually this film addresses racism and sexism in a way that American films can't, which is interesting because McDonagh actually wrote this as well. And this is not as surreal as a Coen Brothers film, but it's also not exactly realistic. There are things that happen in this you think, that wouldn't happen. Or the juxtaposition of things don't make sense.
It kind of ratchets up, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It
almost farcical degree.
Yeah, very, very much so. Satire, yeah. And I think it's such a strong cast. I mean, even Peter Dinklage, you know, he sort of slides in there and plays this sort of... I'm surprised he's playing that character. John Hawkes, actually, I've never seen him looking good. John Hawkes. He always kind of looks like a junkie.
Well, he's sleeping with a 19-year-old now.
He is. It's great. He's sleeping with a 19-year-old in the movie, and she goes, I was reading about polio, or is it polo? What's the one with the horses?
She's a real weird. Everyone's got like a funny line in here. So it is slightly surreal,
yeah.
Like Karen says, but it's a bit farcical. I suppose it's a small town escalation of violence. Like if you know, it's about misunderstandings and cheating and all that. So I guess there's an allegory of something going on here.
And there's a great twist in the middle, which I really don't want to give away, where a character changes unbelievably. And you think that this is the bad apple, we need to get him out of here. Mm-hmm. He's the one that's causing all the problems. And of course, there's a death as well. And then it changes. And you just think, oh my God!
Some people have said, oh, I didn't like that. It's kind of like, oh, you end up kind of sympathetic. I think they're wrong as well. I don't know who doesn't like this movie. Like you mentioned Fargo because of Frances McDormand and small town and police investigation. So it could be like Fargo and become a TV series. You know what I mean? I'd love to see more in Ebbing, Missouri.
Mm. Gosh, I hope they solve the murder before then.
Okay. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri is out on the 10th of November in the US and in January here in the UK.
I'm going to put a bet on Oscar win for screenplay. Win, not just nomination, win.
Good. There you go. Early. Good. I like that. Putting his neck on the block early doors.
I should put some money on it. That would be smart.
Well, you should have done that before you said it. Yeah. You're an influencer.
Now I've ruined it.
Jason, the odds are probably shortening as we speak. Our next film is Call Me By Your Name. This is the latest by Luca Guadagnino.
You're on point today.
That didn't feel quite so good. It tells the story of an American professor who falls in love with a grad student in early 80s Italy, in the north of Italy. Jason, highly praised. Are you a fan?
I'm also a big fan of Guadagnino as a kind of like one of the great European directors on a roll right now. He did I Am Love with Tilda Swinton, which is full of swirling violins and great houses. He's very good at houses, this guy. He's a kind of interior decorator. If he's not going to be a filmmaker, you get him round to do your interiors. He did A Bigger Splash with Ralph Fiennes and Tilda Swinton on that island in Sicily. He's good at holidays, this guy. He's very good at capturing atmospheres that are about sex and love and holiday. Which is what I like in a film. You know, well, right now I could do with a holiday and some sex and some love, but you get it through Guadagnino's films. This is set somewhere in northern Italy near the lakes, Garda, somewhere like that, in the house of Michael Stuhlbarg, who's a kind of ex-American but now lives in Italy doing academic research into antiquity, into sculptures and the kind of sexiness of sculptures. He's even dredging one up from Lake Garda as we speak. And it's about his son, who's like a 17-year-old called Elio, and he's kind of coming of age in this hot summer. I love films about hot summer coming of age. It's lovely. And he's like fancying the girl over the way who's called Marzia. Of course, everyone can speak French and Italian. It's polyglot. Everyone's
that
so
was
easily,
wild. Yeah.
Easily kind of happy. They go for long, cool dips in the local lake, and they go for bike rides in the countryside. They have honey and peaches for breakfast. And you just think, oh. And they got this big house, you know, gorgeous house with a woman who's there, like a nonna making beautiful pasta sauce for lunch. And into this steps Armie Hammer, who's a sort of American 25-year-old kind of postgrad doing some research there. And he's kind of a big guy, and he's kind of got a big, he's a Jewish guy. He's got a big kind of Star of David. But it's all set in the early 80s, so he's kind of listening to the psychedelic furs and kind of got his shorts on. He's kind of easy, and Elio takes a big kind of liking to this guy. But, so it's a kind of coming-of-age sexual kind of exploration of the summer, long, hot summer kind of movie. And I was in it all the way, I have to tell you. I mean, I fancied everyone and everything in the movie. But it's about that. Whether it's a gay movie or not, it's like a kind of appetite movie, the awakening of sexual appetite and exploration movie. And I thought it was sexy and funny and smart as hell.
A visual delight, Karen, and sexy and delightful. But there has been a bit of controversy. There's been some sort of LGBT actors who've said, well, why have we got straight actors playing gay characters? And there's been a I don't know, not a controversy, but it's been a talking point. I mean, is that
the same thing?
Is
we have the yellow
nothing,
face and black face and various faces.
What have you made of
that?
They
don't understand that if, I mean, I can see their point that if we don't start encouraging people who actually fit the role into being the kind of performer that we want, then we won't get funding. But the problem is that I didn't like Guadagnino's previous films, actually. I thought Armie Hammer was terrific in this, but the only way they could have gotten this financed, I think, pretty much was with Armie Hammer. You know, he's a hot guy. You want to see him kissing. I'd watch him kiss anything, frankly. But I think there is a point where you say, yes, we should be hiring people or casting people who actually fit the role, you know, an Asian person in an Asian role, a black person in a black role, a woman in a woman's role. Hey, why don't we do that? But
I don't think he's Jewish, Armie Hammer. Is he Jewish? I don't know. Should he be playing a Jew? It's getting a bit ridiculous, right?
I don't know. I mean, he's too tall. I think we should get Peter Dinklage in there. And no, I think you can carry this too far. I thought this was a beautiful film. I thought it was unrealistic. I thought it was a bit idyllic. This romance. I found it a bit irritating, actually. But it has Armie Hammer in it, and it was fun. And I was just jealous because everybody spoke every single language on Earth.
Yeah,
just slip into Latvian. Okay.
That's a little
bit.
And
the parents are like here.
It's how I feel here in Midori House sometimes.
Oh yeah,
I can
imagine.
Sort of vibe.
But the thing was, it's like you know, Armie's character is staying at the house and they have a double bed. Like, please just sleep with my teenage son. That would like never happen.
He's not supposed to be there. He's supposed to be next door.
Oh, like the parents didn't know. And the parents are like, you know, you had a special friendship there, and I had one too until your mother came along. You know, come on. Anyway.
Call Me By Your Name hits UK cinemas on the 27th of October, the US a month later. Next up, we have Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool and the depiction of Oscar-winning actress Gloria Graham and her relationship with a younger man. Graham's known for her roles in films like Oklahoma, It's a Wonderful Life. Here she's played by Annette Bening. Karen, Benning, discuss.
Well, I was like, I talked to Barbara Broccoli about this, and also Peter Turner, the actor who also the memoirs that... this film is based on. This film's been, most like most films, has been in development for 22 years. So the book came out in the 80s. Peter Turner met Gloria. I'm going to say Gloria Gaynor. You know that's going to happen. Graham.
The same time.
There we go. And Swanson. No. Early, I think, in the 70s. And they struck up a relationship. He had no idea who she was. And then it petered out. And then as this film kicks off, she has collapsed in her, it's the end of her career. She's in her late 50s, which of course means her life's over. And she calls up and says, can I come and live with your family in Liverpool? Because I know I'm not well. And she doesn't tell him, but he eventually finds out what the matter is. Now, Annette Bening wanted to do this role, according to Barbara Broccoli, who produced it, not under Eon, but in another carapace. But she was too young. And the thing that shocks me about this is the way that she shot. Now, this is the DP is Ursula Ponticos, and she looks ragged in every single scene. And you're thinking, wow, it's so, jeez. You know, if Annette Bening looks this bad, there's no way I'm going to be filmed ever again. but it's actually a really interesting film, and because I date younger guys, it was kind of creepy for me a little bit. I was thinking like, yeah. But it really is about love, and it's about vanity, and it's about truth. And I think that the director, Paul McGuigan, does a good job. And I think also it has a global interest, which is unusual for a British film.
And just briefly, we mentioned talking about Annette Bening's performance. Jason, you've already stuck your neck out a couple of times so far in the show. An Oscar chance? I mean, it sounds like the right kind of role.
Enhanced neck as playing Gloria Graham, because Peter Turner says, oh no, she had the scars and everything.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Of work.
Obsessed with her upper lip as well. Yeah.
I thought Annette Bening was terrific in this, and she captured. She doesn't do Gloria Graham. Although I only knew Gloria Graham through her movies. So she gets a little wiggle on, a bit like Gloria Graham, but we get that kind of what was so hot about Gloria Graham when she was in The Bad and the Beautiful.
Apparently she does Gloria Graham through Peter Turner's eyes.
That's right. I think I think the film is terrific. I think it peters out. Oddly enough, over the last 20 minutes, it kind of like, I'm like, where's it going? But I think she's great in it. And what she does is get what is sexy. What she understands what sexuality is, what attraction is, and what great acting is sexy, and flirtation is sexy. The film is very good on kind of class in a way, and families.
Very
which is very
point.
Odd because she had trouble as well because her mum is Vanessa Redgrave, this grand dame out in Hollywood. She was great. And so the contrast between California and Liverpool is terrific.
And Frances Barber just lights into her. It's really about families. Also, amazing supporting cast. I mean, Julie Walters.
Yeah, she's the mum. Yeah. I mean, when she's in Liverpool, I mean, it's real kind of, you know, Freddie Boswell, Liverpool, you know, it's kind of, you know, Stephen Graham's got the haircut.
Very good, very good. And we know the Academy likes films about films or films about actors and actors, acting actors. So.
Yeah. They go to the cinema and they watch some old clips too. So yeah, it's kind of and it's Barbara Broccoli. She knows how to work a room of voters. Yeah, I think big hopes for this one.
One to watch. Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool is out here in the UK on the 17th of November. Those were a few in-depth looks. But Jason, I mean, just to sort of pick your brains, any other things? What other narratives were blowing around? What were people talking about? What particularly exercised you? Good or bad, Jason?
Yeah, I was having a look at the European films, the young British voices. I really liked I Am Not a Witch by Rungana Nione, which is British. There's a film called Apostasy about Jehovah's Witnesses in Manchester, a British film about faith, which I've never seen a British film wrestling with the idea of faith. I thought that was really fascinating. And in Europe, there was a great film from Catalonia called Summer 93, which is really terrific. And again, a first film, and another first film called Ava from France, sort of set on the sort of Atlantic coast on a long, hot summer. I mean, all of those are long, hot summer movies, in which the little kid or the 13-year-old comes of age. There's a thing there with first movies. Mm. And they're always great for about an hour. And then they sort of peter out because the director hasn't quite got a firm. But Ava, I thought, was very striking. And it had a sort of gypsy wedding going on in the sort of Nîmes area. I thought it was pretty amazing looking. It kind of petered out. But it was a, you know, dog. And I just want to look for a couple of films where there was a girl and a boy and a dog on a motorbike, or a girl and a boy and a goat on a motorbike. I don't know what this means, but, you know, probably means I saw too many movies.
Karen, anything else you'd mention?
Well, I mean, I even though I talked about it before, The Killing of Sacred Deer was, I mean, I think is one of the strong ones. And I just think that I missed Downsizing, which I wanted to see, unfortunately.
Yeah, half of it's really funny.
Oh, half of it? Oh, okay. Yeah, see, because he likes to sit in the dark a little bit more than me these days. But I just thought that was like, it sounded like Psycho and it felt like The Shining. So I found that was really...
This is Sacred Deer, you mean?
Yeah. Which, and then I like that a lot. And I just basically, I try to hit the ones that I think are, I don't know. Lean on Pete, I actually quite like too.
Oh yeah, the little racehorse.
Yeah, because I like horses. But no, it was interesting because a lot of people don't know about that world, about the racehorse world, and I thought the performances were quite.
But it was great. That Lean on Pete's great at the racetrack. It's great, and then it leaves the racetrack, and I was like, oh damn!
I know.
Steve Buscemi was so good, and now he's not it anymore.
Yeah, I know, but yeah.
But it's good.
You take. That's the thing about festivals. It's kind of a, you know, suck it and see.
Always a good tip. Karen and Jason, thanks for talking us through this year's London Film Festival. Now, over in Germany, another big event's just taken place. The Frankfurt Book Fair, the world's largest trade event for books, wrapped up last week with France as the guest of honour. And focus next year will be Georgia, and the person in charge of their presence is Medea Metravelli. She spoke to Monocle's own Daphne Karnazes at the fair about the evolution of Georgian literature from the collapse of the Soviet Union until today, and which Georgian authors people need to know about.
Modern Georgian literature, it passed very interesting and challenging period. During Soviet regime, Georgian literary and cultural scene and people were under very big pressure by the Soviet system. To all Georgian titles and writers were under very hard censorship. But after our independence and after collapse of Soviet Union, Georgian authors tried new ways of expression and they started to discuss aloud all problems Georgian community was facing and facing till now. It's our conflicts. You know, we have two very big conflicts with Russia. Our territories are occupied and Georgian authors reflect this reality in their texts. Also, they touch various sensitive themes like gender issues, like our society's response to other challenges in Georgia's everyday life, like Georgian Orthodox Church, like other social and economical and political problems as well.
Do you have a couple to recommend that someone could start from if they wanted to, you know, be initiated into Georgian literature?
I would recommend some titles because as a representative of Georgia National Book Center, it's very difficult for me to recommend one modern author. But I would recommend Guram Dochanashvili's novel, which will be published by Hansa Verlag next year. And also I would recommend Naira Gelashvili's novel, which was also published last year in German translation. So I think these two names will give to German readers very concrete feeling of Georgia and Georgian literary nowadays situation, let's say.
And just finally, I mean, you said Georgia is quite a small country. How big is your presence going to be at the fair? Do you know how many publishing houses or authors will be accompanying you next year?
So we are working on a very interesting program together with our local different culture and scientific institutions. State institutions, ministries are also involved. So we really have very big support from the state. As for our program, and concretely, I would like to talk about the literary component. We are planning to have around 500 events in about 28 German-speaking cities in Switzerland, Austria, and Germany. Georgian authors will travel and participate in 20 festivals in Germany as well. 70 Georgian authors will be presented next year in Germany, and around 130 German titles will be published by around 60 German publishing houses. So this is nowadays figures, let's say, but I think that the program will be shaped and finished by the end of 17.
That was Media Metrovelli speaking to Monocle's Daphne Karnezis at the Frankfurt Buchmesse. Now, as always, we'll end the show with the global countdown. Here's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Welcome, Faye. Before we talk about the countdown, we've set the scene. I feel somehow this week the episode about the sort of sultry Mediterranean summer coming-of-age stories. Anything to add from there?
I do love a coming-of-age story, especially in the summer. You know, a lot of people having beautiful sex, speaking international languages. It's a beautiful thing.
It is.
You know, and actually, I'm a fan of Luca Guadagnino, but I haven't seen the film yet, but I'm curious. I'm curious also to see Loveless. I know it's quite depressing, but...
strikes me that may be from a slightly different point.
Yeah, no summer love there.
No summer love there.
Where, Fernando, are we headed? Is there a summer of love theme or more of a winter of discontent on your countdown this week?
Maybe a mixture, because we're going to South Africa this time. Oh. I know they can have tough winters there, but it's one of the big markets which we haven't covered on the global countdown yet. And but guys, I tell you what, I know I start with number five, but the number one song is great, which is, you know, it's quite interesting.
It makes a change from some of the markets we delve into, but yes. let's head there.
Are you telling me that when we're listening to Spotify, we should actually move to South Africa and listen to some of those things?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, cool.
Let's start with number five. Well, it's an international song. It's been everywhere. It's Calvin Harris featuring Pharrell Williams, Katy Perry, and Big Sean, you know, and the song's called Feels. It's amazing how many people he invites for his songs. But I mean, he's...
Is he just rubbish on his own? And like, if I don't get these people in, no one's going to listen.
Remember, he started as a DJ, so he I think he likes those kind of featuring. I think there's not a single song in his album that is only him, you know. So number four, another, you know, combination between DJ Khaled featuring Rihanna and Bryson Tiller with Wild Thoughts as well, which was one of the hits of the summer. Definitely not the main hit of the summer, but, you know, it was one of them. Number three is a band... I think I said bad things about Dan here in the past. But can I say sorry, actually, because it's Maroon 5. I mean...
Oh, I don't think you need to apologise, Stephen.
They're boring, but they know how to make a good...
It's true.
A well-crafted pop song.
It's true.
You know, they're smart.
Interesting take on the concept of an apology there.
Yes, exactly.
It's so boring.
Can I say sorry to this incredibly boring band?
Yes.
You're boring, but your structure is great.
Yeah, but I respect Dan, you know? And now they have this kind of... tropical house song What Lovers Do with American singer SZA. So yeah, it's a generic pop song.
Okay.
Number two is South African artist. That's a very nice one. Her name is Shekina. The song is called Suited, and it's very cool because it reminds me of 90s R&B. It's like a good slow jam, you know, and it's a very well-produced video. So it's a very good song, not as good as number one.
But what's the thing in South Africa? Because they had a South African hip-hop album that was pretty good because they're pretty good at that. What are they? There's some of them singing Afrikaans. There was that stuff that was coming out from District 9, the movie, and there was all that kind of hard techno out in Afrikaans. What's the musical scene there? I'm getting from this chart that's quite global, and obviously like a bit of Rihanna, and then they've got their own pop stars and their own pop scene.
I think they've been very influenced about the new rhythms. You know, they've been bitten by the tropical house bug, if I can say that. So all the songs have this kind of sort of element, but there's still some kind of South African elements, especially in the number one song, which we actually going to hear a clip. So I want you guys to tell me what you think of it. What an amazing song. Huh? It's I think it's been one of my favorite number ones from recent weeks. He's a DJ, producer and musician also from South Africa. His name is Sun El Musician. He was born in a small town called Moa River. And I was reading more about him. I mean, he's fairly young and he does like the ethereal sounds. He likes a bit of synth, you know, so he's agreeing with me because I love that as well. And, you know, it is a house track, but there are the South African elements there as well. I think you could notice with the beautiful soulful voices as well. I think it's a fantastic number one.
Was that in Xhosa, what the language? Do we know?
I don't know, but I think it's been a mixture of English and Zulu as well. So, but it does feel very South African, and the song has been number one a few weeks already. It's a good
soundtrack to the summer. I thought there was definitely something summery about that.
It's a bit Toto. I thought Africa.
He likes the 80s. He likes the 80s.
That was an 80s summer.
I think he was sampling that Toto.
Good stuff. Jason was rolling up his blazer sleeves already, ready to get into that 80s spirit with that one. Lovely stuff, Fernando. Thank you very much. Where will we go next week?
It's a secret.
Well,
guys, I accept requests. Accept requests, honestly.
Anyway, people, wherever you are in the world, get in touch with Fernando.
And can I be honest, deep from my heart, I was going to choose Russia today because of the Loveless. I wanted to make some sort of association, but the chart was so boring. I was like, I'll choose in the future.
Okay, we'll come back to Russia. Fernando, thank you
very much.
Well,
can I say there is a South African film that won the best first film at the London Film Festival called The Wound. So there you go. Well,
perfect.
Chosen.
We had a theme. Inadvertently, even. Lovely stuff, as always. Great to chat with you guys. Karen Krasanovich, Jason Solomons, and Fernando. Thank you all very, very much. The programme was produced by Holly Fisher and Fernando. I'm Tom Edwards. To play us out, let's have some more of that track from South Africa. This is Akana Marley from Sun El Musician. Thanks for listening.